Islands, I guess you would say, is the proper term for this type of environment. And I'm blessed to be joined by two fantastic individuals that got to have a great session, the foundation session introduce yourselves. Obviously, I know who you guys are. We have Jeffrey Snover at the far end, holding up on the right-hand side of the stage, and we have Mr. Woolsey, Jeff Woolsey, on the side. And I'm Rick Claus, and we are going to be talking about this new thing that we announced today, which is Server 2012 R2, System Center 2012 R2, and how it fits into this whole transformation of the data center.
And the Windows Azure Pack.
And yes. The Windows Azure Pack to fit into that
Can't
as well.
Forget and, that. That's and pretty awesome.
You know, the one thing that I will bring up that you hit on an awful lot, and I'd like you just to kind of explain this for the people that are here, is this whole concept. You kept on talking about three clouds.
Yes.
Now to some of the people that are online, that's a bit confusing for them because they're used to like public cloud and then private cloud, like very simplistic kind of terms where you just kind of, as you mentioned, bolt stuff on. How is this different? Can you explain a little bit about this whole concept of where we're going with this three cloud strategy?
Yeah, so the three cloud strategy basically says that we have a unified management platform, a unified software stack that then can be deployed in three different forms, right? It can be deployed in a customer's website or a customer's site, customer's data center, on their equipment where they have infinite control. They pick the hardware, they pick the configuration, they can control access to it. So it runs in a customer's data center. Mm-hmm. That's a customer cloud. Sometimes you call it a private cloud. Or it can run in the Azure data center. Now there, we pick the hardware, we buy the hardware, and you rent it, okay? And we get great scalability, great elasticity. You can say, hey, I'd like a server. You get a server. You say, hey, I'd like 1,000 servers. You get 1,000 servers. You say, oh, actually, I wanted 200 here and then 200 in Japan. Whatever, and you get that great scalability and elasticity. And then the third cloud is service providers. Mm-hmm. So service providers, you can go and they own the equipment and you can rent it to them. And the great thing about service providers is they can provide lots of value-added services to help you get to the cloud. So that's actually one of the great benefits of the third cloud is that these service providers help people. You know, a lot of people want to get to the cloud but might not have the skill set, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The service providers can help them get to the cloud and then they can stay doing it there or they can decide, because of Microsoft's three cloud vision, they can start off in one cloud and then say, hey, I'd prefer the attributes here or I prefer the attributes there. I start off in the service provider cloud, but I really want the elasticity that I get in Azure. Or really want the control, and so I'm ready to bring it in-house. Mm-hmm. And so the nice thing about Microsoft's three cloud strategy is you don't have to necessarily be right to begin with. You can make a mistake and it's not fatal.
And the important thing is it gives you the ability to move where it makes best business sense for you. For example, I talk with customers all around the world and folks tell me, they say, look, you know, I have data that has to live in a Canadian data center on Canadian soil, run by a Canadian citizen.
You know, you're not saying that's because I'm Canadian.
I'm not saying that because you're Canadian, right? No, I've talked to these Canadians, persnickety. As well as Germans as well that have said the same thing. They said, no matter how great Azure I want it to live within my country, I've got data sovereignty. So are you going to try and push Azure? Are you going to try and, you know, convince me? And no, this isn't a technical argument. It's a business argument. You have legal reasons why you need to do that. Mm-hmm. The last thing I want to do is try and force you to do something that doesn't make sense. That's why with the three cloud strategy, it gives you the ability to run where it makes best and most business sense for you. If it's all about cost and it's about test dev or it's about just absolutely going for the absolute lowest cost, maybe you want to go with a public cloud. Maybe you want to go do something like that. Mm-hmm. If you want to move to a service provider who is in a region where there is no public cloud or you don't have resources and they're already there, they provide you that reach and customization, it can be a great solution for a service provider. A private cloud is about control. A public cloud is about scale. Because with Azure, we can, you know, you can write an application, deploy an application, and then scale that worldwide. And we have customers that are doing that now. So that's why that's such a powerful message and something that's resonating very hard with our customers.
Right, and some of their competitors have a take it or leave it approach to the cloud.
Okay.
Here's how you do the cloud, take it or leave it. And we have the nice benefit, I mean, I just love the position we're in, is that, like, hey, we don't have a really, a dog in the fight. You know, if we're here to help you do whatever makes sense to you, we help you move to the cloud, whichever cloud you want to, whenever and at your own pace. And if you change your mind, that's good too. So ultimately, we get to look out for the customer's best interest.
Well, and the fact that we run our own public cloud is so important. Mm. We have literally hundreds of global services that we're running worldwide. Mm-hmm. So we take so much learning, all of the telemetry, metrics, all of the things that we learn from running our own cloud globally at global scale, then you know feeds the requirements from Azure into how do we deliver the next version of server? What are the features? What is the telemetry? What is the debugging we need? How can we give you the best solution? And by the way, we're going to drive that back into Azure. Azure's going to give us requirements to come into server. And in fact, it's what we call this virtuous cycle for engineering.
Now, you were using one analogy also that I found resonated well for understanding this. Because again, a lot of people view the cloud as a bit apprehensive to get into, or they understand one version and another version. But you were talking about how we're making it and evolving it into the point where it's basically like a plug-and-play service.
Exactly.
And like, is this a serious analogy that you're using, a plug-and-play service?
Yeah, it is. But to be clear, it's going to take a while.
Okay.
It's not something that happens immediately. The original versions of plug-and-play didn't happen immediately.
They took different iterations to be able to get there.
Exactly. But that is our vision. And that's the point I also want to make about CloudOS. CloudOS is not a product. It's not a SKU. It's not something you go out and buy. It's a central unifying vision that then guides all of our decisions. It guides our decisions, our product planning. It's one of the reasons why the teams are working together in ways like every year, you know, you do this poll that says, hey, what's going well at the company, what's not doing well. Historically, year after year after year after year, at the bottom of the list was, you know, we don't work together as a team very well, different product groups. And guess what? That's completely flipped around.
Yes.
We are working together as teams better than we ever had been. If you could go take a look at the things we show, this guy did an awesome demo day. At the end of a release, we bring together all the teams and we say, hey, show us what you worked on. They show the engineers. And team after team after team, it was unbelievable. They got up and they said, they showed these amazing things and they said, and I'd like to thank this team, and this team, because without them it wouldn't work. Mm-hmm. Next guy. I'd like to thank that team, and that team. So the teams are working together very well. So back to the plug and play. Yes, it's a central unifying thought. The hardware abstraction layer, we was originally focused in on a single machine. Now we focus in on the data center abstraction layer. Mm-hmm. And I think that actually has the best example of what we're talking about. And we delivered it in Windows Server 2012. In the past, if you had a storage area network, how did you get that integrated into your environment? And the answer is, with a rabbit's foot, right?
Yeah,
best of luck, my friend. You're going to need it. And some aspirin.
And it requires specialized skills, specialized people, different interfaces, different management techniques, and that sort
lots
of, stuff.
Of aspirin.
I call it the black art of storage myself.
Exactly. And so now how does it work? And the answer is, Windows Server 2012 ships with an SMIS service.
Mm-hmm.
The SMIS service will find, you'll take your storage area networks, just plug them into your network. We will find those, we will discover them, we'll enumerate all the devices, and then we'll make them available to the user. We'll make them available through the same APIs, command line interfaces, GUIs, inbox GUIs, and system management tools that we use to manage inbox Windows storage. So that's a perfect example of taking this notion of plug and play and bringing it to bear on the data center. Now we need to do it again and again and again. It's one of the reasons why I'm so excited about standards-based management and switches. So we showed Arista, not in our session, but in another session.
Yep.
Arista switches have announced that they are implementing standards-based management using our open source stack called OMI.
Mm-hmm.
Now what this means is you'll be able to go out there and buy a Windows logo device, an Arista switch, and say, oh, that Arista switch has a Windows logo device on it. So I can safely buy that, deploy it, and know that now Windows System Center Virtual Machine Manager will be able to find that thing, configure it, and then we were able to tell you about misconfigurations, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you didn't have to go do that and then find some Arista software and get it running on
exactly.
a Windows server. The Arista guys, they're Linux guys, so when we say, hey, you want to write some Windows software? They say, not really. And so we say, that's fine. Implement the standards-based management and we'll talk to you. And it works exceedingly well. And as we release a new version, we don't have to get them to get their plugins requalified.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking to them, so it just works.
You were mentioning as well, talking about with being able to have that standards-based management. I'm assuming that also goes on to support one of your other tenets that you're talking about, which is obviously reducing costs, reducing complexity. It simply strengthens that whole discussion.
Yes.
Because lack of needing to be recertified for that types of plugins, the ability to be able to manage from anywhere. It's the same skill, so that's a win-win for everybody that's involved.
It is, and there's another element to the story that's really important to tell. Because when you put it in that context, you might say, well, hey, the vendors are going to look at this and say, I don't want to participate in that. Yeah, you know?
That was my follow-up, kind of. But
Oh, well, there you go. So the reason why we love this standards-based management approach is these standards, the SIM and the DMTF standards, were designed so that you could implement the standard and then very easily, with very low cost, implement proprietary extensions. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then the consumer gets to use either them as basics or as the proprietary extensions very easily. So it's not do one or the other, you can do both with a small incremental investment. And the work we've done in PowerShell, we show these guys how if they implement it a particular way, Windows will find their devices and auto-generate the PowerShell commandlets to manage it.
Right.
Again, you get full PowerShell commandlets with help and all the rich syntax, taking advantage of their proprietary features and functions without them writing any software on Windows. Mm-hmm. Guess what? That's pretty darn attractive.
Yes.
And you actually demonstrated a little bit of that in the foundation session. I think it was Matt McSpirit came up with his virtual machine manager pieces. At different points, he would always make sure that he drew attention to the fact, click on the button to say view script, and you could actually go off and see the PowerShell pieces for even more scale,
yes.
even better stuff. Now, I'm going to put Jeff on the spot here for just a second and ask about, you mentioned demo days, and it came up in the keynote as being kind of a speed dating for nerds, and just, you know, it's a lot of fun stuff that's in there. But along those lines, briefly, because we, again, this is only a very short live segment we're going to be doing, what would you say would be, I don't know, do you want to go top 10, do you want to go top 5?
Oh, my goodness.
For your stuff? Because both of you, obviously, are very deeply involved with the
yes.
whole side of both System Center 2012 R2 and Windows Server 2012 R2. But if you had to narrow it down, do you want to do 5?
Oh, my goodness. I'll come up with a few top ones. I'm okay. not going to give you a number, but I've been asked this question a number of times.
I won't hold you to a number. But
especially after the keynote today.
The standout ones.
There's a number of things. First of all, again, everything we showed in the keynote, I always have to remind people, we only have a few minutes to touch on a couple of things in the keynote.
To be exact, I believe it's 18 minutes per section, if you measure it out.
I think, yeah, I didn't have 18 minutes, but I promise you that. But the point is, we have a tremendous amount that we're delivering in Server 2012 R2, whether it's, again, Hyper-V, whether it's networking, whether it's storage, whether it's automation, PowerShell. Mm-hmm. We've done a tremendous amount of work across the entire platform. So, again, it's hard for me to come up with three, but there's a couple that definitely do pop, and it's one of the reasons why I showed it today, which is storage tiering. Storage tiering, oh my goodness. I mean, after our session, I had another session following that, I get mobbed with people asking me about storage tiering because they are floored because we are harnessing the power of SSD mm-hmm. and we're harnessing it for good. Okay, I mean, what we're doing is we're basically saying, look, we're going to take a couple of SSD and dramatically reduce your cost per IOP. Because we're going to introduce storage tiering. We're going to make it really easy. A point you always like to stress is we like to make the complex really, really easy that anybody can use, and that's exactly what we're doing with tiering. It's why I went through the process of actually creating the storage tier and yeah. then deploying it and actually showing you the crazy performance. So tiering is one that just resonating across the board with everyone.
Because there were questions on the Twitter stream during the keynote and also during other sessions saying, is it really that simple? Like, because you literally just selected the disks
yes.
and then filled in the rest of the wizard and done.
Yes.
And
that's
all there is to it.
Yes. That, again,
we call it software.
Again, there were 20 physical hard disks and
right.
4 SSDs. That's it. There was nothing magical. It was all real code, all real test, I promise.
So there's actual hard code numbers behind those dials that were going.
That was all real. Yeah. And again, 20 physical disks, 4 SSDs. We walked through, we actually created it. Number of things to point out again is we have both mirrored versus a simple types of reliability. We also introduced the new three-way mirroring to give you additional resiliency mm-hmm. against multiple disk failures. And then, yeah, it's like, okay, now that we've got this, let's go show you what the performance looks like. And it's really astonishing. There's different types of tiering. We have automated storage tiering. We also have pinning. So pinning is where you could say, you know, I have this super important file, and I want you to take this file and always stick it in the SSD.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of automatically finding the hot blocks and putting the hot blocks in the SSD tier, mm-hmm. you could just say, you know what, this file is always important. Just keep this file always in the SSD tier. So for example, if you were doing a VDI deployment, maybe you wanted to have a golden master image sitting in the SSD pinned. Guess what? You could do that and make that your master image. So there's a whole bunch of really fantastical things about tiering. Haven't, you know, didn't get a chance to show this, but we also have a write-back cache. So that this allows us to really, you know, even out, even as you have really spiky performance and you have really spiky workloads that are doing all sorts of things to really stress your storage out, a write-back cache just makes this really consistent. Mm-hmm. It's really awesome. Deduplication, as I showed earlier, on running virtual machines. So now it's about, you know, oh, you're counting.
I've just seen how many you're up to now.
Oh, man.
Three so
the, the fact that, you know, you can run them on running virtual machines now is just amazing, because things for like VDI, where you can have a lot of common blocks there, can give you tremendous capabilities. Obviously, the live migration stuff is just awesome. Mm-hmm. I mean, live migration compression is one. The live migration, the last one I showed, which is the new live migration using SMB Direct and RDMA. Here's a little insider tip. When I ran the test this morning, when I actually did it in the keynote, that was the slowest that it's run all week. I was actually surprised that it ran that slow.
Oh, yeah?
It was still a lot faster than the compression version. It was still a lot faster than what we're shipping today. But that was the slowest that the RDMA had run all week. It's still early. We haven't even given out the preview bits yet. So we got lots of tuning and tweaking to do. And you can expect these numbers are probably going to get even better.
I particularly like the RDMA one because it proves our operating system approach to the problem. I mentioned a number of times that our competitors view the cloud as something you bolt on top of a static operating system. And we fundamentally disagree with that approach. We take an operating systems approach to it, which is say operating systems have two missions. We manage hardware resources for multiple consumers, and we provide application services. And our vision of a cloud OS is to execute those two missions in the context of a data center. Now, what that means is we'll make any change at any layer of the stack in order to get the right semantics, okay? And so what we did in 2012 was we said, hey, we want to have fantastic performance at low latency with low CPU. Mm-hmm. So we took RDMA and we plugged it into the system. Mm-hmm. And then we layered SMB on top of it. And now, having laid that foundation work, now in this release, we're able to do live migration on top of SMB, which then uses RDMA. And so we get fantastic, like crazy. Did you demo the live migration?
Yes.
Oh, I wish I'd saw that. Anyway, just crazy, like mind-boggling stuff with that. And I can't believe you didn't talk about parallel rebuilds. Like one of the most exciting things. You're just a dope. No, the parallel rebuilds. This is interesting. A little bit geeky, but I love it. So here's the basic problem.
Go hardcore geeky, Jeff.
Yeah, okay. So here's the basic problem. The I.O. to a disk really doesn't change that much. There's only so many I.O.s you can do. Now, the disk capacity keeps growing, but the IOs don't change. So now imagine I've got a mirror disk, okay? And I'm writing, every time I write to one, I write to another. And then this disk fails. What do? And the answer is, I got to read all the data from this disk, and I got to write it to this disk, okay? Now, that says, however much data I have on there, I've got to read it, and then I got to write it. So there's a number of IOs I have to do. That means I got to read them all from this disk and write it all to that disk. And guess what? If that determines how long it takes. Now, because the IOs stay the same, IOs per second stay the same, as the capacity grows, right? We had 1 terabyte disks. Mm-hmm. Those were amazing.
Yeah.
Now we got 2 terabyte disks.
Now
we got 4 terabyte disks, and it's going even bigger. That when that disk dies, that's each, you know, I have 8 terabytes worth of IOs that need to occur all on this one drive.
Yeah.
So what that then means is the time that if something goes wrong with that drive, I'm totally screwed, goes right through the roof. Because look,
this is a family show, Jeffrey.
Oh, it's Men in Black moment.
Yeah, that's right.
So anyway, so what we do with these parallel rebuilds is we say, hey, we're going to take these this data and we're going to stripe it across a very large set of disks. Mm-hmm. You can stripe it across dozens of disks. Then when a disk goes down, what we do is we get the data from dozens of other disks and all write to other, you know, replace one machine. So what that means is the time that your data is at risk dramatically decreases. And by the way, when I'm getting all the IOs from one system, guess what? People are trying to use that disk.
Yes.
So now I'm trying to use it, and I'm also trying to rebuild it. So you got contention like heck. So this parallel rebuild, kind of geeky technology, but here's the deal. When something goes wrong, you're covered. It's not like something goes wrong, and then it goes wrong, and then it goes wrong, and then you're sitting there saying, oh, these computers are hard.
Oh, my goodness. You have you stopped at around 3 or 4. There's
you didn't mention desired state configuration.
We don't have
your
enough
turn.
Time to go
your
through
turn.
Everything.
You go. You go.
I'm not going to get five, but I'm going to talk about desired state configurations.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay,
talk so about. You got to.
Jeff got about three. We'll give you at least one. Because,
okay, I'll do
because
this one's my favorite
you go
one.
Into such depth.
Well, here's the deal on desired state configuration.
Yeah.
So in so I started the PowerShell journey in 2001. In 2002.
Hold on. This is the father of PowerShell right here. Okay. This is the father of PowerShell. Let me take a moment to say, everyone here at TechEd, I've gotten so many people say, we're just using PowerShell for everything, because in Suver 2012, PowerShell was implemented just literally everywhere. Mm-hmm. All the demos you see in all the keynotes, all the demos you see in us doing the sessions, all the demos, PowerShell unmistakably is under the covers helping us do all the automation. So this is the man behind it all, Mr. Jeffrey Snover.
Yeah, it's a pretty good day.
You can pay me later for that one.
And it's yearly calibration time.
So. Nice.
Oh,
remember that.
Even better, nice.
Anyway, desired state configuration is the latest addition to his baby.
It has been a very long road. It's been a very long road. In 2002, I wrote the Monad Manifesto, where I highlighted the key things we needed to get to from where we are to a fully automated system. In version 1 of PowerShell, we delivered two of those. In version 2, we delivered the third. In version 3, we delivered the fourth. And now, in PowerShell version 4, in Windows Server 2012 R2, we deliver the final rung of this. And this is management models. And these management models are basically desired state configuration. Desired state configuration, I explained it like Star Trek. Remember that great Jean-Luc Picard? He'd sit there and he'd say, the world ought to be this way. And he'd go to his number one and he'd say, make it so. And that poor guy, he's like working his butt off, like, yes, sir. And he's doing all the work, whether it takes this or he takes that. He's got to bring more people on board. He's just, Picard's sitting there like drinking his tea.
Earl Grey, hot.
You know, he's just having a good time. Well, that's way we want you to be. We want you to say, I want my data center to be this way. And then the system goes and makes it so. And that's what we've done with PowerShell. Now, this is version one. It'll take a while to be fully fleshed out in the same way that the initial versions of PowerShell took a while to be fully fleshed out. But that's the path we're going down. And I'll tell you, we knew about this stuff. We knew it. We developed it. We know the story. We know the benefits. Mm-hmm. But as we were getting ready for the show, we're actually using it. And I just cannot tell you what a joy. I mean, how much fun was. It's like, oh, I messed this up. Oh, wait.
Hold on. Clean system. Yep.
Rebuild the system. You'll assert VMs and it works. It's like, oh, this is so cool.
Yes.
So the nice thing about it, by the way, I don't know about you, but I hate systems that make me feel stupid or systems that make me scared.
Yeah.
Right? Like, ooh, if I do this, am I going to lose my job? Or what the heck's going on?
It's that half-second hesitation before you press that button to execute the command or whatever happens to be. Is it going to work right? I don't know.
Exactly. That's why I added minus what if to all the commands that change state.
Yeah.
Well, in the desired state configuration world, it's even better because you just, yep, I screwed it up. Fix it. Fix it. Fix it. And it's just wonderful. I mean, you just got to use it. It's just crazy cool. It really
is. With your Star Trek analogy, though, you know, Are the redundant disks, are they going to be like the red shirts that can just disappear and then come back on again as they need to?
That's great. So. Lieutenant Worf or whatever.
No,
he was a main character.
It was Lieutenant Ricky, usually. Random red shirt of the day.
Oh, my goodness. Oh.
I did that with my kids. It's like, that guy's going to die. How'd you know that, Dad? You'll figure it out.
You figure it out when you get old and you get to feel.
I think we're getting a little punchy. We've been here all day.
Yeah. We're coming up to the last couple of minutes that's going to be coming up on this, so we have to be kind of nice and tight for a couple of different things. You listed off a bunch of stuff, but you're all talking about storage. Is storage the only major area that we may
buy? No.
I don't want to say that, because that'll seem like it's just...
But it's one of the biggest transformational things.
What would
things
be the next major, biggest wowser kind of fire-breathing dragon solution besides the storage pieces that you're already talking about?
Well, first,
it just gets a little bit of airtime.
First of all, take a step back. Again, it's a like 2012, it's a holistic release. We've made changes in automation, in storage, in Hyper-V and virtualization, in networking. It literally is across the board. So again, while storage is getting a lot of nice press today, and deservedly so, I mean, the tiering stuff is great. Hyper-V has some fantastic things, the live migration. The other thing I do want to point out is the cross-version live migration. I didn't get a chance to demo that this morning, but literally, you know, one of the things that's really important is if you've set up your 2012 private cloud already, we want to make sure that we make it easy for you to go to 2012 R2. Mm-hmm. So you can literally drag and drop your virtual machines, live migrate them on a 2012 R2. And if your 2012 R2 is using tiering and deduplication, guess what? Your VMs just automatically take advantage of that.
Right.
And we're going to make it real easy to keep doing that forward. We want to make that an easy upgrade process.
Yep.
So that's a key capability. Some other things that we haven't had a chance to really dive into are some changes, for example, we made also for, you know, for the remote experience and for users and for, you know, user-centric computing. Mm-hmm. You know, we want to make sure that whatever device you're running on, you get great fidelity, great performance. And the RDP protocol, for example, has taken great strides forward again. And in fact, for Hyper-V now, you can get full-on copy and paste into your guests.
Mm-hmm.
You can get audio now out of your guests. You can get USB support into your guests. And all of this just continues to work with live migration. In fact, one of the coolest things about the RDP capabilities we have now with Hyper-V is you now you can remotely debug a virtual machine, or you can even remotely diagnose a virtual machine, even when you've actually disconnected the virtual networks into the VM.
Okay.
So we've done some really exciting things to actually solve some of the really hard problems, like debugging VMs and things like that.
Yeah, or like working at the BIOS level.
Yes.
Right.
On a Linux machine.
Nice.
Yes.
Yes, I mean, the significant improvements for the Linux guest as an operating system for dynamic disk and dynamic memory and that sort
dynamic
of stuff.
Dynamic memory for Linux,
in there,
yes. Online resize.
You've got 10 seconds apiece to basically say which would be, if you had to pick one session of TechEd to be able to watch again, which would it be? Because you'll be able to watch all these sessions on demand after the fact, just one. You can be your own if you want to pimp your own one, but if you want to pick somebody else's, what would it be? And I'm going to let Mr. Snover go first.
Yeah, you should go watch my desired state configuration. Pay no attention to what Jeff says. Go watch my desired state configuration. It was fun. It's fun. You're going to like it.
Nice.
Are you done now?
You can repeat mine if you want.
There's a lot. It's killing me to say one. I'm going to do it. Go see Jose Barreto's session.
Oh, he's a rock star.
He's going to show off all of the storage stuff.
Oh, yeah.
He's going to show off scale-out file server, deduplication, tiering, you name it, in massive detail.
Awesome stuff. Well, good thing is I've got Jose.
Ben Armstrong, I do second.
Jose coming on the live set later on this week, so it's going to be good. Thank you very much, gentlemen,
Thank
for taking
guys.
The time out of here. I appreciate you running all the way down here from the other end of the hall. We got to throw it back to the Taste of Tech Ed for the next session, and we're out of here. Thanks, guys.